come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of
Words on a Wire.
On this week's Words on a Wire, we have a novelist, Alex Espinosa, whose latest novel is entitled
The Five Acts of Diego León.
And I'll be reading a poem by E.E. Cummings.
And on Poetic License, we have a graduate student from Arizona, a brilliant young woman named Lauren Espinosa. So stick around. Ben, I love El Paso. You know that. I mean, if anyone loves El Paso more than anyone I've ever met, it's you, but I'm the second in line, right?
I
love El Paso.
Right.
I think it's a beautiful place here. However, when it gets windy, it is one of the most horrific places in the world to live. And it has been windy now for over 24 hours.
Well, that little wind led me to take a Benadryl this morning.
The thing about El Paso, I remember one day when I first started here at UTEP as a professor, they actually canceled class because of a wind day. It was so dusty, you couldn't even see on the highway. That's unusual.
Well, it's not that unusual to get winds with gusts of 85 miles an hour.
Yeah, and it carries the dust with it because, you know, we're in the desert and it carries the dust. And so you feel dust on your teeth, you feel dust in your mouth. And then the worst part of it is so much dust gathers on your window panes, no matter how greatly you're insulated, that you could actually draw pictures on it.
And the other interesting thing about the wind, not always, but sometimes it signals the beginning of a cold front.
Right.
So we'll have a nice day and then a windy day. And the next day, well, it feels like winter again.
But you know what? One of the things I do like, what correspondence that I enjoy is that wind, you know, I'm kind of like trying to dabble in Hebrew, in ancient Hebrew. And wind in Hebrew is ruach. And ruach also means spirit. And so every time the wind bangs against my windows and it bangs the Mexican elders against the walls of my house, I think, the spirit's trying to get in.
Well, at the very least, when it's windy, we know that the world is still alive.
And an ahua to that. Stay tuned and we'll talk to Alex Espinosa and we'll talk about his new novel, The Five Acts of Diego León.
Here on Words on a Wire.
Alex Espinosa was born in Tijuana, Mexico. He came to the United States with his family at the age of 2 and grew up in suburban Los Angeles. Author of the critically acclaimed novel Stillwater Saints, he received an MFA from the University of California, Irvine. He is a recipient of the Margaret Bridgman Fellowship in Fiction at the Breadloaf Writers Conference and currently an associate professor of English at California State University, Fresno. This is his second novel, The Five Acts of Diego León. Alex Espinosa, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you here. We both just read The Five Acts of Diego León, which has just come out from Random House. It's quite a story. It starts with a little boy, if I could just summarize it a bit, a little boy in Michoacán growing up near Pátzcuaro, which has a lot of, if you don't mind me saying, duende in that area. It's a really, really incredible area. And then he ends up going to Morelia and living with his rich, aristocratic, and very white Mexican grandparents. And then he goes to Hollywood and he breaks into the business. And what's really beautiful about the transition from Morelia to Hollywood is he's going as a, I guess you could say, a Mexican immigrant, but he's going to break into the business, but it's at a time when the talkies are about to emerge, when we're leaving the silent movies and we're going into the talkies, which even complicates a bit, things a bit for a Mexican actor trying to break into Hollywood. Tell us how you got this book.
Well, the book began when I encountered an interview in the Los Angeles Times about Ricardo Montalban, the actor.
Yeah.
And Ricardo Montalban in the interview was talking about his experiences as an actor of color in Hollywood and how frustrated he was at times because he was consistently being typecast.
I remember his commercial, the rich Corinthian leather.
Yes, exactly. And, of course, Mr. Rourke on Fantasy Island.
Yes.
And And, you know, Ricardo Montalban was really frustrated oftentimes because he was always being typecast, and any opportunity he had to break out of that, he was met with a lot of resistance. And that really sort of fascinated me, the idea that, you know, that he as an actor was called to play anything but a Mexican, usually. Mm-hmm. And then around this time, I also encountered, through my research, I found the Spanish-language version of the Todd Browning classic Dracula that was filmed at night with an all-Spanish-speaking crew. Because, you know, in Hollywood, before talkies, you know, it was very easy for studios to export their movies to foreign audiences. They didn't have to deal with dialogue. And sound introduced a whole set of complicated issues, and one of those was, how do they take this movie and export it to a foreign audience when you have actors speaking English? So their way around it was to produce two versions of the same film. You know, there was a Spanish language version of Dracula that was filmed at night on the same set. And I thought that that was just an interesting metaphor to use, and it was something that I just sort of mulled over for quite some time. And I decided, in doing my research, no one had ever really written a novel. No one had ever fictionalized the experiences of a Latino in Hollywood during the 20s and 30s. And so I sort of took it upon myself to do that, and that's how the book began. And it was quite an experience, and I came to realize that Latinos have had a hand in shaping and influencing the film industry from the very beginning. And I wanted to pay homage to that somehow. And so the book was sort of born out of that experience, and it sort of came about in the way that it did because of all of those experiences that people like Ramon Novaro, people like Dolores del Río, and people like Ricardo Montalban and Anthony Quinn had when, you know, they were met with this giant studio machine that was all about reinventing people and making them anything but what they were. And so that's how it came about.
But it's really interesting because those three people you mentioned were very famous. Anthony Quinn got to be he always got leading roles. Ricardo Montalban didn't get leading roles. He played important roles. Mm-hmm. But he was never the leading man.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And you know, that was another thing, too, that I sort of explored was the way in which, you know, Latinos were never, you know, hardly ever asked to carry a film. And it took some time before they were actually sort of top billed. But it was very common for them to play, you know, secondary or tertiary roles to, you know, I mean, look at like Marlon Brando in the film. Yeah, exactly. He sort of was cast as the lead. But you hardly ever had a Mexican as a lead during that time. It was very unheard of. And so, you know, the Trailblazers really had to fight, I think, to get recognized during those early times. And it was a really difficult experience, and it was a very alienating one as well. I mean, Ramon Novaro was not only dealing with the experiences of being an actor of color in a system that was consistently typecasting him and pigeonholing him, but he was also in the closet, which was really difficult. Wow. And that made for a sort of the complexity was even more nuanced in the case of someone like Ramon Novaro.
You know, what's interesting is that this book really kind of shows us, it really does show us the invisible Latinos in Hollywood. And I was recently in Hollywood. I spent spring break there, actually. I rented a little bungalow near Hollywood Boulevard, just because I like to walk around Hollywood. It's an interesting area. But one of the things that I noticed as I was walking through, you know, the various streets that have the stars with the names on it, is every now and then I would come up to a very clearly Latino, probably Mexicano name, and I didn't recognize it. And I thought that would be interesting to go through the Walk of Fame, take all the Latino names and do research on who they are. But perhaps they're these invisible people that you're writing about.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that was what sort of attracted me to this character and to writing this experience, was because I wanted to sort of shed light on those experiences of so many. You know, there are so many that have come and gone that we don't even know, who have sort of slipped through the cracks, and there's no documentation of them. I mean, and these things are still happening. It's still relevant. I mean, look at the recent uproar over Lupe Ontiveros' snub from the Oscar, when they pay homage to those that have passed on. And as Latinos, you know, we're consistently being met with and facing a system that you know, for whatever reason, doesn't recognize us in the way that we would like to be recognized. Mm. All those stories are out there. I mean, you have people like Leo Carrillo, and you have, you know, Gilbert Roland, and you have these actors and actresses who were there from the very beginning, but whose experiences have never really been explored. And the studio system is so big and so iconic that I wanted to sort of take a slice of it and pull it out and to explore the experience of a fictional actor in Hollywood during this time to see what issues of identity, of history and memory, and the sacrifices that we make as artists come up in this book and to see if I can shed light on the complexity of the experiences of Latino film industry.
Well, how much research did you do on this book? Did it take you months?
It took years. and I mean, I did everything from, you know, watching tons and tons and tons of old movies from the 20s and 30s. I drove around Hollywood a lot looking at the old buildings and mansions. I researched, of course, in Mexico. I did a lot of research into the Purépecha culture, the experiences of Mexicans in Morelia during the 20s and 30s. You know, Morelia was a really cosmopolitan city around that time. There was electricity, and there was a lot of, you know, there was an intelligent citizenry. I read books. I looked at old photographs. I looked at the old rail lines running through Southern California, the big red trolley cars, everything. And yeah, it took me about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I tell my students that research is incredibly important when you're writing something, and you should allow yourself to spend a great deal of time just trying to absorb as many of the details as possible in order to create an accurate picture of the time and the place that you're writing.
And yet to research in a novel can't ever feel like research.
No, it can't. It can't. And you can't just dump it in there. It has to be, you know, woven into the fabric of the novel as seamlessly as possible, and so that's a real trick.
Did you find that very difficult?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But I also found that, you know, I had to remind myself that I wasn't writing a history textbook. I was writing a novel, and I think that distinction is very important for us to remember. As novelists, we have the ability to, you know, to be creative in the way in which we integrate the details, in the way that historians have to deal with facts and all of those things and write it in such a way. I think when we're writing novels that have some elements of history in them, we can take some liberties, as long as those liberties are within the, you know, within the parameters of the book and of the period. But I think it's also important for us as writers to sort of stretch our imagination a little bit when we're incorporating some of these details. So it's really tricky, as you guys know, being writers yourselves. But it also, I think it's just also part of the world building that we do when we write.
The story of Diego is really a story of somebody who's becoming a performer. And there's other stories which we'll talk about in a little bit. But he's trained in Morelia by a very nice woman who believes in his talent. He's trained in opera. He's trained in dance. But his very first experience on stage is the Danza de los Viejitos. Mm-hmm. And I love the way you describe it, and I love the sounds of that dance. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, that was actually, I was doing research for my first book when I was in the Pátzcuaro region, and I knew of the dance, of course, growing up. My brothers themselves in elementary school in Southern California had performed it, and they remember wearing the mask. And the whole motif of the mask, when I was doing research, I ended up actually doing a tour with a tour guide who sort of took us to a lot of the local villages that dotted the lakeshore, Lake Pátzcuaro. And one of the villages that we visited was the village of Tócuaro, where a really famous mask maker lived, and he had his shop and his studio all set up. And this tour guide knew him, and so we were able to get a very close, very sort of personal tour of this man's studio. And the tour guide and the mask maker himself explained to me the whole idea behind the Purépecha's fascination with masks and how we walk around basically what we're wearing. Our face isn't our true face. It's sort of a facade, and it isn't until we put a mask on that we become the actual people that we're supposed to be. Mm. And so, you know, the idea behind the dance of the old men is this sort of this very sort of like cheeky, funny performance. You know, you have these boys dressed up as old men, you know, and they dance around and they pretend to fall over. It's very exaggerated, very sort of funny, very whimsical. I like the idea of Diego himself as a young boy putting this mask on and sort of, you know, that echoing what he's going to be doing in the future, which is, you know, acting. And what is acting but just donning more masks
right.
and pretending to be something that you're not. And so the Purépecha belief that we all wear these masks and that we're never showing our true face was something that really enticed me. And I remember the tour guide saying to me, well, maybe someday you'll write something, you know, that pays homage to this whole belief that, that as Purépechas we wear these masks and we walk around never showing our true face to anyone. And I just thought, huh. I sort of left, you know, and I remember that thing, you know, and the mask maker, Javier, gave me this really wonderful little mask that he had carved, and he signed it for me. And because he found out I was Purépecha, he sort of took me aside and separate from the rest of the tour, the group, and said to me, like, I want to give this to you. And so it was a very special gift for me, and that was something that I used as sort of inspiration when I was writing this book.
Wow. This, in many ways, is a story, coming of age, a building roman even of this actor, you know, who goes from, we follow him from a child all the way well into adulthood. But it's also a story of sexuality. And I'm thinking of that scene after the two kids, Javier, I believe is the name, and Diego are drinking pulque for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than Diego going home, Javier says, well, just come sleep at my house. And there's that beautiful, tender scene where Diego sees Javier remove his clothes, and he just says, this is beautiful. And there we start another story. Can you talk a little bit about how that deepens the story or how that happened?
It was funny because a professor who teaches here, a good friend of mine, well, who taught here, who you may know, Daniel Lillian Faderman.
Oh, yes, I remember Lillian.
Lillian had me over for dinner one night, and I was telling her a little bit about the book. And it was, this was, you know, this was when I first came to Fresno State, so the book was still forming. And Lillian said, sort of very matter of fact, you know, she sort of turned to me and said, well, he's gay, right? And it was one of those moments I still remember where I thought, you know, maybe he is, I guess he is. and sort of in asking me that question and forcing me to answer it, it was almost like Lillian was giving me permission to go there. And I think that what I wanted to do more than anything with that aspect of Diego's life was play again with this idea of the mask, of identity, mm-hmm. of, you know, the ways in which we, you know, oftentimes go on pretending to be something that we're not. And how when we're not true to ourselves, the devastating repercussions that can come from that. And Diego sort of exploring his sexuality and coming to terms with who he is, I think fits well with the theme of the book, which is this whole idea of exploring your identity and just mm-hmm. coming away from it, getting a greater sense of who you are and what sacrifices you're willing to make. I was really grateful for Lillian when she asked me that question. You know, mm-hmm. it was just sort of like, huh, well, I guess he is. And that was the thing that I was sort of tiptoeing around. But I wanted his sexuality to be yet another way in which Diego himself is complicated and, you know, refuses for many years to acknowledge who he is, but then in the end sort of comes to terms with it and realizes that it's not as bad as he thought it was going to be.
But I like the idea of a double mask. He's an actor, and then he's masking the fact that he's gay.
Exactly.
And I like think that works really well.
Yeah, especially that scene not wanting to marry who his grandparents want him to marry. And so when he leaves, when he flees that relationship, he's fleeing it on really many thematic levels at once.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I needed to raise the stakes. And I think that at that moment, you know, his fear of marrying this woman, this sort of moment where he realizes maybe this isn't the life that I want. You know, my grandparents have been really supportive, and his grandfather's basically handing him the keys to the mansion and saying, right. Here you go. You know, it's all yours. You're going to inherit it. But Diego knows deep down inside that's not what he wants. You know, he's always looking for something. And I think that the minute he sees not only the prospect of marrying Paloma and having to go on pretending to be in love with her, but also the idea of when he encounters his last name not being Leon in the announcement in the paper, mm-hmm. but his grandfather's last name, and he remembers his father's, you know, words, make sure that they remember who we are, that you're the last of your kind. And when he encounters that, it's just another realization that he will be forgotten if he doesn't do something about, you know, changing his story. And so he decides to flee, you know, and the only thing that he can do is pursue this sort of vague dream of becoming an actor or a performer. And it ends up ultimately leading him to Hollywood, and, you know, which is all about reinvention and, you know, reconstructing your identity and sort of, you know, that notion gets even further complicated when he ends up there.
And that's exactly what we do when we write novels. We reinvent and we reconstruct.
We do, exactly. We do. Again and again and again, over and over and over. And each time we do it, we sort of fall, you know, we fall deeper, deeper and deeper into this sort of labyrinth. And then we sort of find ourselves in there, and then we're like, okay, now I have to get myself out, right? And how do I do that?
Exactly. We've been talking to Alex Espinosa here on Words on a Wire, author of The 5 Acts of Diego León.
Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Thank you. This is fantastic. And I can't say enough again, Daniel and Ben, what a big fan of your work I am, both of you collectively. I remember when I was a graduate student, you know, at UC Irvine, encountering both of your works and, you know, seeing your stories and the characters that you guys are writing about, you know, gave my work the validity that I felt it needed. And so I want to thank you also for being so wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much. You're very
kind. And it was fun hanging out with you in San Antonio a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, it was wonderful hanging out with you. I'm so glad we had a chance to chat.
And we got to do it again sometime.
We do.
Okay.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks again, Alex. Our poem of the week comes to us from the very famous E.E. Cummings, who needs no introduction. Somewhere I have never traveled gladly beyond. Somewhere I have never traveled gladly beyond. Any experience, your eyes have their silence. In your most frail gesture are things which enclose me, or which I cannot touch because they are too near. Your slightest look easily will unclose me. Though I have closed myself as fingers, you open always, petal by petal, myself as spring opens, touching skillfully, mysteriously, her first rose, or if your wish be to close me, I and my life will shut very beautifully, suddenly, as when the heart of this flower imagines the snow carefully everywhere descending. Nothing which we are to perceive in this world equals the power of your intense fragility, whose texture compels me with the color of its countries, rendering death and forever with each breathing. I do not know what it is about you that closes and opens. Only something in me understands. The voice of your eyes is deeper than all roses. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. That was Somewhere I Have Never Traveled Gladly Beyond by E.E. Cummings. Coming up next is our poetic license by Lauren Espinosa, so stay tuned.
My name is Lauren Espinosa, and I'm an MFA student in poetry at Arizona State University, and this is my first year there. I previously came from the University of Texas Pan American, where I had the opportunity to work with some great faculty members. And the poetic license that I'm interested in talking about today is about Latino identity in poetry. And the reason for writing this is came out of a roundtable on emerging Latino voices that I'm doing with a couple of other students in MFA programs that are Latinos. And this is going to be featured on the Poetry Society of America website, I guess later on in April. And so this is, I guess, part of the introduction that I'm working on and something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I'm, as I try to create work and as I try to like read other people's work. So in the introduction to The Other Latina, Writing Against the Singular Identity, the editors Blas Falconer and Lorraine Lopez wrote that all Latinos share some Latin American heritage. Apart from this, there is no essential or singular trait of Latino identity. Nonetheless, in the United States, Latinos or Hispanics are often viewed as a monolithic and homogeneous group. From such reductive and oversimplified ideas of cultural identity, the Latino writer often appears on the scene as mediator, translator, or insider ethnographer, bearing literary artifacts from the native culture to enlighten and entertain members of the dominant culture. He or she often succumbs to the pressure to support the illusion of cultural cohesion despite multiple variations that challenge, counter, and flat-out deny assertions of sameness necessary for promoting even the feasibility of a spokesperson. So taking that quote, what I did is I formulated a response to it, taking my ideas about how Latino poets, we function through identity but also outside of it, and how we work to make culture a part of our poetry but also accessible, and what we're doing to create documentation about that. So I think that it's interesting in the descriptions about identity, the idea of documents and documentation. And the reason for my contemplation of this being twofold. One, as poets, we are creating, documenting what it means to be Latina. So of course, there'll be some monolithic moments where creating a world for an outsider reader. And I don't think that this is something that we should be wary of. Rather, we are the heart of the cultural movement within Latinidad. Even now, I go to concerts or cultural events, and even those are very obviously not poetry readings, there is still a poet reading his or her work involved in the event. In reading at these events, we are then becoming the source for what is being added to the conversation about Latinos, Latinidad. The spokesperson, yes, but not the final authority or definition. And two, the question I also wonder about in terms of documentation is how we are as poets and as Latinos, because I think it's useful to distinguish between the two, using the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, as Audre Lorde would put it. I say this because there are so many moments in history where marginalized groups do not speak for themselves. History is written without them. I think, for example, of my own family history, of my abuelito being a bracero. I do not know, in his own words, what it was like. I forever mourn a past that can never recover. As poets working within Latinidad, we have a collective past that we will never recover because it is not documented. And because, in terms of history, the braceros were an undocumented, quote, people. So consider for a moment that shift, the shift in not having documents in a historical and metaphorical sense to creating them, a shift in responsibility from being a consumer of a text about oneself to a creator. The possibility of this existing as a way to negotiate conquest may appear singular and static and reliant upon the master's tools, but it is dynamically encompassing of all Latinos in its possibility toward phenomenalness.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We'd like to thank Alex Espinosa for talking about his incredible Hollywood experience and his new novel, The Five Acts of Diego León.
We'd like to thank E.E. Cummings for being a poet.
And Lauren Espinosa for that wonderful segment on Poetic License. Make sure you join us next week and every week, Sundays at 11:30 a.m. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.